Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Transfigured. I am with my friend Moises. Moises, do you want to introduce yourself? Because this is your first time on my channel.
Sure. My name is Moises Pacheco. Moises is Spanish for Moses. Most people call me Mo. I am currently a pastor in the Christian Reformed Church doing a church plant on the west side of City of Chicago, Chicago proper. I come from a Puerto Rican background, lived on Chicago's west side my whole life. I love the fact that we're having this conversation because Harry Potter is a big deal for me. It's one of my biggest hobbies right now is Harry Potter reading, watching, discussion, etc. So I am married, have three kids. We'll see
if I have any more. You're a member of the Chicago meetup group, I should say, just in case anyone is watching this channel and somehow doesn't already know and also lives in Chicago. We have a meetup estuary, Jordan Peterson discussion, PVK discussion group thingy that meets once a month in Chicagoland. I'll put the link for that in the description of this video. And we'd love to have you, just in case you're coming to this video and happen to live in Chicagoland. Moises is one of the pillars, I'll say, of the Chicagoland meetup group. And we want to talk about Harry Potter. We were kind of supposed to have Kale and Richard Rollin in this conversation, but they got busy or had things come up. And so this might be the first conversation that has a follow-up with both of them involved. But that doesn't prevent Moises and I from having a bunch of fun. So, Mo, when did you first read Harry Potter? And what did you think, I guess? What sort of like initial introductions and reactions?
So, actually, my initial introduction would have been the movies, but... So my niece is a huge Harry Potter fan. And so growing up as a kid, that's around the time the movies came out. So I took her to the opening night of every movie, but I was doing it for her. I was in my 20s. I didn't care. And so I didn't pay much attention. I might've actually fallen asleep because there were midnight showings at each of them. But I encountered the movies again during the pandemic. You know, you got a lot of time at home. And after watching the movie series, again, I was walking through Target and saw the Sorcerer's Stone. I was like, oh, let me pick this up and see what I think of it. And that was in 2020. I got hooked. Since then, I've read the entire series probably about five times and listened to them in audiobook once. And So, it's been 4.5 years of immersion.
Yeah. So I remember when they first came out as books, I was like, I'm basically the exact same age as Harry Potter. I think maybe I'm a year older than him. And so I was like right in the target demographic of because they were sort of written for the age kid that Harry was at the time. And the book sort of grew up with you. So I was perfectly primed to be a Harry Potter fan. Except I, like many preteen boys, I did not enjoy reading. And I'll say, you know, my parents were a little skeptical of Harry Potter, you know, because of the magic stuff and the witches and wizards and witchcraft and being, you know, pretty connected with the Christian right. But they didn't like put their foot down and say, no, we're not going to read this. So I actually remember driving home, I think from Christmas one time, this probably would have been right after the first book came out. We somehow had a copy. Maybe I'd gotten one for Christmas or something from a relative or something. And we read it. I read it out loud to like my family on the drive home. And the first book is pretty short. You can actually, I think, basically read it in one sitting. And I remember liking it and thinking like, this is a good book. And my dad, I remember being like, oh, that's not as bad as, you know, Focus on the Family or whoever made it out to be. Yeah. And I remember joining the book, but then I didn't carry on. But I remember I had friends who were like hardcore Harry Potter, go to Barnes and Noble at midnight, or at the crack of dawn or whatever, get the book, read it that entire day and then talk about it for the rest of, you know, the next couple months, and then, you know, just wait for the next book to come out. And I was sort of the kid, I don't know, I didn't like fads as a kid. I was always suspicious of fads. Harry Potter struck me as a fad. And even though I will say I'd enjoyed the first book, I didn't keep up with it. And then when, after I graduated from college, I had some time. I had like a 2 months between when I started my first job and when I graduated. And I don't know why, but I'm like, I'll read the Harry Potter books. I want to read something. I've got some time. How about the Harry Potter books? And I just devoured them. Mm-hmm. Like, I read them so fast. It was like my full-time job for like a month was reading Harry Potter books, maybe even less than a month. And I was just like, well, these were so much better than I had imagined. And I remember being struck. I didn't know who Jordan Peterson was at that time, because that was before he was really famous, or before I watched, you know, philosophical videos on YouTube or anything like that. But remember thinking, like, you know, these are strangely Christian. Perhaps the greatest irony that I noticed when I was about 22 was, like, you know, so there is a magically born person whose parents are sort of gone. There's this God the Father guy, and there's certainly Satan, and there's people on either side, and you kind of have this Messiah who has spoilers. This whole video will have spoilers. We make no apology for spoilers, except for this. And he dies to kill Satan and then rises again. And then there's like a last battle. And honestly, what Harry Potter sort of reminded me of was the Left Behind series in a weird sort of way. Did you ever read, I mean, you're Calvinist, so maybe you didn't read the Left Behind series.
I wasn't always a Calvinist.
All right.
So I went to Moody Bible Institute where, you know, Jerry Jenkins worked.
All right. So you got plenty of dispensationalism in you then.
Yes.
Did you ever read the Left Behind books?
I did not. I think I watched one or two of the movies. I was never a big reader either. Like, at that time that Harry Potter came out, I wasn't even aware of the books, mainly because I was into comic books at that time. I became aware of the movies, of course, in the evangelical world, you know, it was the witchcraft, should kids watch the movies, but I didn't really care because I wasn't a kid anymore. And I knew my niece liked it. I loved my niece, so I would take her to watch it. And they seemed just lame to me. I remember her getting emotional as the older ones came out. Like around Dobby. And I was like, I don't care about this little creature. And then it's like, now it's hard for me to watch, you know, the seventh movie where Dobby, you know, dies. And it's just like, it's an emotional thing. And it's like, I've watched a couple of reaction videos where people are crying at that point. And I haven't cried at that point, but I've come close. Like, it's emotional. It's like you develop, because there's an aspect of the character there that is that there's a reality in. And that's what I have found very compelling. You know, you mentioned Jordan Peterson. Jordan Peterson always talks about Crime and Punishment, and he talks about the significance of that book is that the debates that happen are authentic debates. Like, there are perspectives that he doesn't agree with, but he writes the debate steel-manning that perspective. And I feel like this is what Rowling does with these characters. She imagines these characters in the realest possible way. And as I read them, I'm like, yes, if I was this character, I could totally see myself doing this. Or I've encountered somebody like this acting this way. And I hate that they're doing this right now, but it's so real to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I read them when I was 22, right after college. And then my wife and I also read, I read them to my wife while my wife would be nursing our first child. So after our first child was born, to spend time with both of them, because, you know, mom's just nursing all the time in those early stages, I read the Harry Potter books out loud to both of them. And that was another touching time. And I agree, like, each time you read them, there's I feel like they get more and more interesting, or there's more and more depth, mm-hmm. or especially like, you know, before we turn the camera on, Mo, you said that one of your favorite feelings is ending the seventh book and then going back to the first. And I feel like you can see so much of, like, when the first book came out, I don't think people had any sense that there was this whole seven part plan that all fit together. And I don't know personally how much Rowling had the whole thing mapped out, but she had to have had at least some of this mapped out, because there are so many breadcrumbs in the first book even that only make sense in the light of later things that you come to learn. And I don't think it was just like happy coincidence or retconning things back or something like that. I think it must have been very carefully planned. And like I said earlier, I think that the books are shockingly Christian, and that I actually think that they might be a better Christian allegory than Narnia or even Lord of the Rings. Now, I should say Tolkien obviously has a complex feeling about allegory, right? He doesn't want any of his characters to be too closely a one-to-one map of Jesus in the story. And so he sort of spreads Jesus out amongst a bunch of characters, like, you know, Frodo is sort of like the suffering servant carrying his cross up the hill, Jesus, and Aragorn is like the kingly line being restored sort of Jesus, and Gandalf is sort of like the priestly Jesus or something like that. But, you know, Jesus is spread out. Whereas in Narnia, Aslan is just sort of God Jesus. But I think that, and I will also say, partly my biblical Unitarianism might come through, is that I really think that Harry Potter is a much better Christ allegory than Narnia is, because Aslan is so other in Narnia that he doesn't really have, you could say, a human nature or something like that, because he's just sort of God Jesus. And I think part of the problems with Narnia is because Aslan's so powerful, it's sort of like the Superman problem. The only thing driving the plot is like, is Aslan present or not? Because as soon as he's present, then like it's, you know, there isn't really anything, any contest. But in Harry Potter, Harry actually isn't that powerful. He is pretty good at some things, but he has lots of weaknesses. And you certainly get the impression that, aside from some weird contingencies, Voldemort would be able to just rip him to shreds. But there are, you know, some weird things that happen that prevent that from happening. But that Harry really has to like summon up courage and summon up strength and grow as a person in order to defeat Voldemort, instead of just like, oh, he's present now, so of course he's going to defeat the bad guy or something like that.
Well, and there's a couple things that you touched on there that I found interesting. First of all, it's the power dynamics. One is, I do think Harry Potter is a bit more powerful than people give him credit for. And I also think that Voldemort isn't nearly as powerful as people give him credit for. But I think part of the whole underlying message there is that, to a certain degree, it's not really about power. And this is where the Dumbledore character comes in, is that it's not about power and it's about other things.
Yes.
But also, one thing I've been thinking about lately is, in the Reformed tradition, we have the Heidelberg Catechism, which expressly kind of, it speaks very emphatically against trying to portray any image of Christ or any image of God, period. They call it idolatry. And it's one, if you kind of read the Heidelberg and you really take it at face value, even like the Narnia series would be kind of against that.
Would be getting too close to that line.
Yeah. Part of it, the reasoning behind it is because it's saying you can't fully capture God. You can only capture an aspect of it. And so I think Harry Potter is a better Christian book because Harry is more of the Christian than the Christ, because as a Christian we're supposed to do our best to emulate Christ, but we'll never be able to do it fully. So Harry is more of a Christian story of a Christian living out that Christ pattern than it is the actual Christ pattern, if that makes sense. And that's why I'm drawn in more, because it's like I can see more how I can try to live out this Christ pattern as a fallible human, then and I can never be Aslan, if that makes sense. I can't identify with Aslan, but I can identify with Harry. And so I feel like, you know, if we're going to use Paul's language, Harry Potter is a very Protestant book, and maybe even a reformed one at that.
And I liked what you said about in Harry Potter, it's not just about power, because it can kind of feel like in Lord of the Rings that you really just sort of at some level have to have a more powerful army to win. And maybe, you know, there are themes of loyalty and betrayal and bravery and stuff like that. And yes, there is sort of Frodo, the unexpected halfling, who is able kind of through overlooked weakness to find a vulnerability. But at some level, there also are just armies clashing on a battlefield and strength and power is just sort of, you know, there's nothing really about the good side that makes their goodness more strong than the bad side. Sometimes it just is arrows and swords and stuff like that. Whereas in Harry Potter, it's very, like, because of the magical dimension, power is very psychological as opposed to just pure strength. And that you can see that in, like, a lot of the spells and charms and stuff like that are basically sort of like magnified expressions of psychological forces and dimensions. Like the Patronus charm, in order to get it to work, you have to think of like a really happy memory. And find, like, you basically have to dig into your reservoirs of joy in order to, and what's the Patronus charm most good at? It's the most good at fighting the Dementors, who are the things that suck life and joy out of you, even unto death, right? So there's this sort of suicidal, almost ideation, joylessness that needs to be fought with you remembering your happiest memories and using the strength that that gives you. Right, so it's a very psychological, mental dimension.
And J.K. Rowling even affirms that, that as she was writing the Dementors, it was a time she was struggling with depression, and they were supposed to be symbolic of that. And one of the ways to treat depression is to, you know, in terms of, is to rethink memories, and especially your happy memories, and unpack why they were happy, and what the, and the meaning of those memories. And another aspect of that same thing, the psychological aspect of it, is the ridiculous in the same book, that you take some of those things that you fear and you make them ridiculous. You make them silly, you make them funny, and then all of a sudden they're not as scary anymore. And that's that's very psychologically powerful there.
Like you're learning mental habits to fight the bad kind of internal demons or thoughts with something stronger. You fight kind of depression dread with joy. You fight fear with kind of humor or laughter and that sort of thing. And that Hogwarts is like this training ground to do that. But instead of it being internalized, it's sort of like allegorized in these external battles between characters and lessons in magic class and stuff like that. And in that way, because that's sort of the rules of the road of the Harry Potter universe, it means that to defeat Voldemort is much more than just like, who's more powerful, Dumbledore or Voldemort, or Harry or Voldemort or something like that, who's just going to win the arm wrestle or something like that. It, even Dumbledore has to figure out sort of by the rules of this kind of psychologically magnified magical landscape, what the weaknesses are of Voldemort. And it's actually very tricky and hard to find the path to actually beat Voldemort. And it's much more about the internal battles of good versus evil than it is about strength on the battlefield or something like that.
And that battle, good versus evil, is both external and internal. I mean, to a certain degree, Dumbledore defeats himself. He's killed by his own killing curse, rebounding, because and Harry,
you mean Voldemort is killed by himself.
And Harry explains to him exactly what's gonna happen. He's like, that Elder One is not gonna work for you. Go ahead, try it. but he can't let go. And that, I mean, Harry even tells him, try to repent, you know, try to have some remorse, and but he can't do it. And to a certain degree, as I said, Harry is not the Christ figure, but the Christian trying to live out that Christ pattern. Dumbledore is not the satanic figure, but he's a human living out that satanic pattern. And he can't never repent. And because he refuses to repent or show remorse, he ends up destroying himself. And this is kind of the idea if you give into that evil. Because of those that create evil, they have a certain power. I mean, we think of some of the serial killers like Jeffrey Dahmer. He can take life at will. That's almost like a superpower. He's killed so many people, not necessarily because of his power, but although he had a bit of it to overwhelm some of these people, but that he was willing to go that far. And then you hear about from the guy who kind of presented the gospel to Jeffrey Dahmer in prison, that Jeffrey Dahmer has a realization, oh, I don't have to be evil. Like, this could apply to me. There's another serial killer, I believe the BTK killer, bind, strangle, or bind, or something like that, I forget. But they said as he was giving his confession, he was like the devil himself. He was just no emotions, just talking about how this person like begged for their life and I just strangled them to death. You know, so non-emotional. But during his sentencing and all the victims, family members could confront him and, you know, people are cursing him out and he's just sitting there like he doesn't care. But then one father gives up and he says, you know, you killed my daughter. You make it difficult to live out what I believe. And I believe that Jesus forgave us and we're called to forgive everyone. And I forgive you. And at that moment, the serial killer, who showed no emotion at all, broke down and started crying. Because it's like, he's not Satan, but he's a human that was living out that pattern. And he could be redeemed if, you know, because he's human. He has that potential to be redeemed because Jesus can save. And so Voldemort, you have, again, Harry living out the Christ pattern, not just in sacrificing himself, but in reaching out to the most evil person perceptively and calling him towards remorse.
Yeah.
And Voldemort refuses and then destroys himself. And that is the pattern, is if you refuse, you will eventually destroy yourself.
Yeah. And I think that the path to becoming Voldemort is also interesting too. That it is a path. I think that probably the main central theme of the books is death. I think that really at its, I don't know, core, the Harry Potter series is about dealing with death. Mm-hmm. And the dichotomy then is between Voldemort, who is constantly searching for immortality, and the way that he tries to search for immortality is by killing other people, because that's how you make a Horcrux, is that you have to kill someone else in order to make a Horcrux. And so he's trying to split his soul as sort of a eggs in many baskets insurance policy to make himself immortal, but that's at the expense of other people. Mm-hmm. And then Harry's path to immortality is, or to defeat death, is to be voluntarily willing to die yourself. Mm-hmm. And that's actually how you defeat death. And Dumbledore sort of does it first, and then Harry is able to do it too. And that it's immortality through other sacrifice versus immortality through self-sacrifice. And I don't know what's more Christian of a theme than that.
Yeah, and the self-sacrifice, and it was what I love about the book, isn't simply death, but it's death. It's that's for the sake of others, and sometimes that's dying during life. It's just self-sacrifice in the moment of, I want this and I give this up for others. Because this is also the big difference between Harry and Voldemort. Voldemort is alone. He won't, even Bellatrix wants to be in with him, and he refuses because it's like, no, I can live forever. And Harry, by encouragement of Dumbledore, is let everybody in. And Dumbledore actually sacrifices some of the potential of his life and where he's able to go to maintain others in his circle. And so, and this is why I think one of the last lines Dumbledore says to Harry is, do not pity the dead. And this is one of the things you'll see everybody watching the movies. Sirius dies. I feel so sorry for Sirius. Fred dies. I feel so bad for him. Dobby dies. I feel so sad. And then after all these people are dead, even Dumbledore says, don't pity those that died. Pity those that live without love. Because what, in the movie, this is illustrated even better, I think. When Dobby dies, his last words are, I am happy to be with my friend Harry Potter. It's like, if I'm going to die, this is the best death ever, as I died saving the most important things to me. And that starts at the very beginning with Lily and James sacrificing themselves to save what was most important to them. Is in that case, you're almost happy that I died that way. Even Sirius, he's trapped in that house. He can't contribute to the fight at all. But he died so quickly. But he died saving the most important to him thing to him in that moment and helping the cause. Like, his death meant something great. And so it's not simply that the self-sacrifice, but self-sacrifice in the name of love for the sake of others.
Yeah. It's as if no man had greater love than this to lay down his life for his friends. Exactly. That seems to be the core message of the books. I wonder where that idea came from.
And I do wonder how much Rowling knew that to begin with. And how much she just kind of started writing and let her creativity flow. And then that's what came out.
I wonder that too. How intentionally, because she does quote the New Testament a couple times. And I think mainly in book 7, like, isn't it on Lily Potter's grave, perhaps, where it says, and the last enemy that shall be defeated is death. And like, you know, okay, that's pretty on the nose. You know, it's one thing to have Christian allusions. It's another thing to quote the New Testament on a gravestone. So I wonder how self-aware Rowling was of trying to tell a Christian story versus that just being, you know, following sort of the logos of the story that she had initiated and that being the only place that it could really go that was artistically fulfilling versus sort of knowing that ahead of time. I wonder about that.
Yeah, well, and I think all the things were there. I mean, raised in England, I would imagine she might have been part of the Church of England, maybe even an anomaly. She's very well read, it seems, in terms of mythology. So I think there are pieces that were there. Whether or not she consciously was thinking, hey, this is a Christian message I want to convey, I'm not sure. Maybe she was, but based on some of her political views, I'm like, I would be surprised. I think when you're trying to examine reality at the deepest level that you possibly can, maybe this is just the pastor in me, you end up with the Christian story because that is reality on the truest of levels.
Yeah. And I'll even say this. I hope I don't creep out too many people, but I think that she's gotten me to think about how many parts of the Bible are really the kind of logic that they are is magical logic. That atonement itself is sort of in that realm of magical thinking. And I do not mean that as a dismissal or a downplay of the importance of the atonement in any way. But like, as a Christian, when you think, how exactly do we imagine Jesus's blood as atoning for our sins? Like, what sort of, by what logic are we reasoning with when we say that? Like, is Jesus's blood a disinfectant that is removing sin bacteria from your skin? Well, no, that's ridiculous. We all know that's not what it means. So we're not at like the clinical form of logic or something like that. It's like, what are we talking about when we say that Jesus's blood washes away my sins? It is like a magical form of reasoning, and that it's almost as if magic, and again, perhaps magic isn't quite the right word because it has connotations that I don't want, because obviously in many ways the Bible condemns magic, but perhaps also it is sort of the right word that of what I'm talking about, that at the core of theological reasoning is something that is very akin to magical reasoning.
Well, yeah, and I would agree with that because it's like in every course of study, and again, we see this with Peterson now, we see it with Tom Holland, the deeper and deeper you study anything, you're going to get to a point where you can't naturally account for it, because that's where the God comes in. That at some point, God has to be the originator of it. There has to be an unoriginated originator, an unchangeable changer. And so magic is another name for that. It's something that we can't understand, can't explain, supernatural. That's kind of what God is. And I think the Enlightenment and like logic, all those things are incredibly helpful and to analyze and unpack, like we're doing with Harry Potter. But at the end of the day, you're never going to, you can't escape the supernatural aspect of life, of the reality. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I think atheists really lose out on, is when they get to, I mean, the typical answer is just time. Well, you know, what originated the universe? Oh, well, it's just been continuing through infinity. Okay, well, that's more of a cop-out than it is anything else. Because that infinity, well, that's God. That's, like, where you can't escape that infinite aspect of it. You can't escape the magic, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, and that it is almost as if, like, some of the liturgy and atonement theory and stuff like that are sort of at that realm of symbolic psychological meaning that is almost really indistinguishable from magic. And this is another thing that's brilliant in Harry Potter, is that the more powerful the spell or the more powerful the potion, the harder it is to accomplish. Like I was watching the sixth movie last night in sort of preparation for this. And what's his name? Who is the professor of potions that Slughorn. Comes in? Slughorn. Yeah. So Slughorn in the first class, he's like got these, you know, super special potions. And one of them is that Felix Felicis, which is like the liquid luck. Mm-hmm. But he says it's incredibly difficult to make. It's very expensive. And if you mess it up just a little bit, then it can be very dangerous, right? So it's a very powerful potion, but it's also very expensive and difficult and hard to get to. Mm-hmm. And like the spell that brings Voldemort, that reincarnates Voldemort, basically, is, you know, when Wormtail, and it's also interesting that Wormtail is the one who's able to do it, right? It's like the bones of the father and the blood of the enemy and the flesh of the servant or something like that. You know, it's something very, it's like a bunch of very complicated, hard to get ingredients, and that Voldemort had been plotting for a while, and it took him a long time to come up with a plan that could assemble the ingredients for his reincarnation, or however exactly you want to think about that. And this logic that the harder something is to, the more important something is, the more powerful something is, the harder it is to get there, kind of is a very compelling part of the sort of the rationality of the universe. Yeah.
Like, even in the world of magic, it's like, well, magic, isn't magic supposed to make our lives easier? Like, you see some of the little silly spells of they're washing the dishes by itself, and, you know, they can make food and all that stuff. Magic's supposed to make things easy, but magic can't make the most important things easy. The most important things are always going to be hard. Which actually, to a certain degree, brings me to one of the something I've been thinking about lately, which might be very controversial. I don't think Rowling would approve of anybody analyzing her writing in this way. But there's a lot of similarities between Harry and Voldemort, both growing up as orphans.
Yeah.
But one of the big differences is that Harry's parents loved each other. He grew up as an orphan because they were killed. Voldemort's parents didn't love each other. And so what's kind of presented there is, and as people have theorized this, I don't know if they necessarily agree with it, but that Voldemort couldn't love because his parents didn't ever loved each other.
He wasn't created by love. Yeah.
He wasn't created by love.
His mom came up with a love potion to seduce the hot muggle down the street and had bewitched him into not even really loving her, but, you know, being infatuated through the powers of love potion, mm-hmm. right? Whereas Harry's parents loved each other. Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and so now we take that principle into reality. You know, how many people have a hookup, a one-night stand, they get pregnant? And you could go take this back before the pill, before reliable contraception. Well, now you have a baby here. Does that baby stand a chance without the parents that love him? I mean, and then you have parents that don't really love each other, but get married. But at least they love the child. Where Voldemort didn't receive any of that. But now you take that in today's world, where contraception is widely available. But there are still some people kind of born into that mess a bit of not having parents that ever loved each other, that never loved them. And is like, is the message of the book saying that it's impossible for them to actually love?
I'm not sure if she would say it was impossible, but I think the point there is that love is necessary to create a person. Mm-hmm. And this is a very Vervaekian point. He says that in his video about agape, that agape is how we turn things into persons, how we mm-hmm. personify something is by agapeing them into their own unique personal existence. Mm-hmm. And it's as if Voldemort had been deprived of that.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I'm sure there are people who are born not through love that then can turn out okay, but they probably needed love from some unexpected sources or, traditional means or something like that.
Yeah.
Or can find ways to forgive their past and move beyond that. But it is, and because I feel like, you know, a lot of people, it's very almost trite today to say that love will win or love conquers all and stuff like that. But I feel like Rowling really earns that and like mm-hmm. really helps explain why it is that love can defeat evil and why love can defeat death. And
which brings me to another character that you mentioned, and that's the Snape character.
Yes,
because a lot of people say, well, he was unhealthily infatuated with Lily. I disagree. I think he had that unconditional, unending love for Lily, mm-hmm. like that, and that never ended. And this, to a certain degree, this is why Dumbledore is surprised when his Patronus is still the Doe. It's yes. wait, Lily's been dead 14 years. Hasn't this infatuation worn off? And he's like, after all this time, he's like, always. He's like, I will never stop loving. And I will do everything for this little child I even can't stand because it's so much like his dad. But I will do it not for him because I actually love her. And she's the only person that he ever loved. But because he loved her truly, he ends up being able to contribute to the side of good.
Mm-hmm.
And I think
Voldemort... Yeah, Voldemort at some point tries to dismiss his feelings for Lily as, you know, lust or basically something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Doesn't he say that he sort of let Snape lust after her or, you know, like,
yeah.
or something like that, underestimating the power of love and mm-hmm. that it really is like... Snape has perhaps the hardest job in the whole book, and he also has to sacrifice himself. You know, the number of people who sacrifice themselves for Harry is Harry's dad, Harry's mom, Dobby, Dumbledore, Snape, and maybe even some people that I'm forgetting about all the way along the way. And it keeps gnawing at Harry Sirius and all mm-hmm. all these people that he loved keep having to die for him. But that's true. But I think Snape has one of the hardest jobs because he has to be a double agent, mm-hmm. In a double agent that can trick Voldemort. And that the way to trick Voldemort is to underestimate the loyalty caused by love.
Yeah, because Snape wasn't loyal to anything else. Like he truly did not care. Like to the point where he became a Death Eater. Because he's mm-hmm. like, oh, I'll join this side, it's power, whatever. But the moment that conflicts with his love, like, well, if he really loved Lily, he would have never become a Death Eater. No, because Lily didn't love him, at least not in the same way. He wasn't the object of her love. Maybe she cared about him as an old friend, whatever. But the fact that he couldn't really love her like he wanted to. Well, I'll go, because I don't care about anything else. But the moment she becomes endangered, and this is testified to by Dumbledore saying, why don't you just ask Voldemort to spare her? He's like, I already did. Because he doesn't care about the kid. He doesn't care about James. He only loves her, but loves her to the point where he'll betray anybody.
Right. At that point. And we get the impression that part of the reason why Harry's parents were killed was because Snape had betrayed them in the hope that maybe Harry's dad would die and perhaps even Harry would die, and that would leave Lily again available for him. Mm-hmm. And that is the selfish love. And then he learns, you know, and like he really doesn't like Harry, but he learns to mature in a love that is other focused and not self focused. And yes. And to not give in to resentment and to heal from that. And in that way, I think Snape is one of the most interesting and compelling characters in the whole book and one of the most admirable.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how much he actually healed. I mean, he was able to become functional and do the duty. But I think what it was a kind, you know, and it, we can argue, it can be argued whether this is good or not, is because his love for Lily was put at the top. Mm-hmm. Everything else was organized under that principle. She's dead, but I can still love her until I'm dead, basically. And so Harry, I don't like him. And this is why he bullies Harry to death. He bullies everybody because he doesn't really care for them. But as long as I'm protecting him, I'm still loving her. And so his love for her, but to a certain degree, she's not put at the highest because she's dead. She's gone. Mm-hmm. The love for her is put at the highest. And so, and that allows him to play his role. And to a certain degree, you know, the ancient people had this idea of living forever is through having kids. And even if you ever watched Coco, the idea of continuing on forever is being remembered forever. And so through his love for Lily and acting upon that, Harry names his son after Severus, Albus Severus. And so his name continues on, even into potentially into eternity. Not because he was good necessarily, because it's very debatable. He did a lot of really awful things, but because he loved Lily and loved and acted out that love for Lily.
Yeah. And Peter Pettigrew is sort of like the anti-Snape, right? Because he was also one of the people who was instrumental in them getting betrayed, because he was sort of like their, he was their secret keeper, right? What am I remembering that correctly? Yeah, that yeah, he was the Harry's parents' secret keeper, and that he betrays that loyalty and he never seemingly repents and is loyal to the Dark Lord, mostly out of fear, or something like that, right? Because that's really the only kind of loyalty that Voldemort can ever get is fear-based loyalty. Although Bellatrix isn't fear-based loyalty, so it's a little bit more complicated than that. But like Peter Pettigrew and Snape are sort of the anti-characters of each other. And Harry's, well, I mean, at some level, Harry's anti-character is Voldemort. Because I was about to say that Harry's anti-character is Malfoy, but that's not exactly true, because Malfoy does, you know, become good in the end too. And Malfoy has his own interesting redemption arc that comes from sort of, because another thing that is very interesting is that Malfoy's mom also is one of the ingredients that helps defeat Voldemort, because she lies that Harry is dead, because Harry dies, comes back to life. She goes back to him and realizes he's still alive. And all that she cares about is getting her son out alive. So she asks Harry, is Draco still alive? And Harry says, yes, he is. And that's all that she cares about. She's willing to betray Voldemort for the love of her child. And Voldemort keeps running into this problem where mothers really love their children. And it's really hard to get what he wants done because of these mothers loving their children.
Yeah, and that's the thing that, you know, Dumbledore constantly says is that Voldemort can't account for love because he doesn't understand it. He doesn't understand what it means to love somebody so much that you don't care about living anymore.
Yeah.
And I think this is a true human experience. It's like, oh, to a certain degree, coming into adulthood and maturity is coming into the point where there's somebody I'm willing to die for. Somebody that I'm willing to not accidentally die for. Is there somebody I'm willing to stare death in the face and you know, and greet it as an old friend on behalf of this other person? And you see this happen over and over. It happens with Dobby, Sirius, Lily, Harry. I mean, Harry and Lily, it's the obvious. And Dumbledore, I'm willing to go to death for this. But everybody's kind of making that statement is, I'm willing to die for this because this is more important than my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I mean, it's certainly funny, as a pastor, that's what I'm trying to guide all the people I pastor towards.
Yeah. And it's funny, you can even see this theme in the very first book because there's the Sorcerer's Stone who is able to grant, what's the name of the couple that's living off the Sorcerer's Stone in book number one?
Flamels, Nicholas Flamel.
The Flamels, right? And so they have, you know, basically a source of immortality, but they eventually realize that it needs to be destroyed because the danger that it has is being able to grant Voldemort immortality. Mm-hmm. And so even though they've been living however miraculously long a life, they eventually are able to greet death when they're ready for it, in sacrifice to not enabling Voldemort. So in a certain sense, you could say that the Flamels also willingly embraced death on behalf of Harry in an effort to beat Voldemort. And that's in the first book. And I hadn't even thought of that until just now.
Yeah, that's a big thing. I mean, and there's so many things that just break down so interestingly. I mean, like, for example, so the idea of prophecy and... I guess prophecy and predestination, fate, sovereignty of God type things. Like how Dumbledore says the prophecy is telling you what's going to happen. It's not telling you what has to happen. Like, don't you want to be the one that ends Voldemort? He killed your parents. And Harry's like, yes, I want it to be me. Because it's like, you don't have to do this because the prophecy tells you you have to do it. You do it because you want it to happen. You want Voldemort to go down and you want to be the one to do it. The prophecy is just telling you that. And it's similar with the sorting hat. This, like the sorting hat doesn't tell you what house you're supposed to be in. Like it does. Dumbledore says, I think the only mistake the sorting hat made was putting Snape into Slytherin. But it's not telling you where you're supposed to be. To a certain degree, it's telling you where you want to be. But you don't always know where you want to be. But the sorting hat searches your values and places you where your values dictate. And this is why it's telling, you know, based on what's inside you, Harry, Slytherin could work for you, but Harry doesn't want Slytherin. It's like, how in the world did a coward like Peter Pettigrew get into Gryffindor? Well, because part of it is he meets James and Sirius and he says, that's what I value. I want to be part of that. And then he ends up pursuing something else. Similar with Neville, because, you know, you mentioned Peter Pettigrew being like the opposite of Snape, but to a certain degree, he's the opposite of Neville, because Neville, or they're very similar. There's a lot of parallels there. Neville comes in as this weird bucktooth guy.
He's a tag along to the cooler kids.
But both put in Gryffindor because they at least value the bravery. And so they're there, but Neville ends up making the choice to confront his friends, where Peter Pettigrew never confronted his friends. And that's a big difference there. So the idea of values, and again, this is something I think we've come to appreciate Jordan Peterson for, is the whole conversation around hierarchies of values, and even trying to understand our own values that we have maybe never have considered before.
And I think, you know, the dramatic climax of Harry Potter is we get introduced to these Deathly Hallows in book 7, although it turns out we've had one of them the whole time. We've had the invisibility cloak the whole time. But there's the story of the three people who escaped death, and they get given three rewards for this: an invisibility cloak, a super powerful wand, and a resurrection stone. But it turns out that some of these things, while you think you might use them to prevent yourself from dying or prevent other or reverse the effects of death, it's actually these things that drive two of them to get killed, right? The magic wand or the elder wand causes the first person who has it to be killed by someone trying to steal it from him. And then the resurrection stone drives someone crazy enough by who keeps resurrecting his former love to want to join her. And so these things that were supposed to reverse the powers of death still strangely has powers over them, although the invisibility cloak is a little bit different.
And although that pattern still exists with the invisibility cloak, because why does he give up the invisibility cloak?
Why?
Because the third brother gives it up to his son, because there's a knowledge that my son can't escape death. But in order for my son to escape death, I must submit myself to it. And so then he gladly does it. Like it says, I greeted death like a friend, because now I my son.
Yes. And instead of sacrificing your children for yourself, you sacrifice yourself for your children, right? That has the redemptive pattern in there. So Harry, in the last scene where it takes him a long time before he really understands what needs to happen. And this is another one of those things that just is like bone chillingly awesome about the books to me, is that Dumbledore, after relatively early on, figures out what needs to happen. We're not quite sure when Dumbledore learns, Voldemort has hidden his soul in seven different places. In order to kill him, we're going to have to kill all of these. Also, by the way, one of them is Harry himself. And so the only way to kill Voldemort is for Harry to die. And there's the scene where Snape confronts Dumbledore, and he's like, you've raised him like a pig for the slaughter. I mean, I suppose we couldn't say sheep, because that would be just a little bit too on the nose, obvious. We'll say pig, right? And this is one of the things that I think, I wonder how much J.K. Rowling was wrestling with, why is it okay for God to have sacrificed his son for the world? There's something about that that seems like the reverse, that seems like the bad pattern, right? You know, parents are supposed to sacrifice themselves for their children, but weirdly enough, in the Christian story, God doesn't sacrifice himself for his son. God offers his son up as a sacrifice. So like, what's going on there, right? We've got this weird sort of bend in the rules. And I think that J.K. Rowling is really wrestling with, why is it okay that at the center of this Christian story is God raising up his son only to kill him in a way that seems kind of evil? And that I think that Harry, to me, the most compelling part is when Harry realizes what needs to happen, realizes kind of after Dumbledore has died, right? It's basically through the memories that he gets from Snape, right? As Snape is dying. And he takes those back to the memory thing whose name I'm forgetting, the Palantir?
Pensieve.
And then kind of gets the last download of information of, I need to die. I need to let Voldemort kill me. And then he has the powers of the Deathly Hallows. He has all three of them, although he doesn't have the wand in his hand, but it's technically loyal to him at this point in time. And instead of using them to prevent himself from dying, he uses them to give himself the courage to die. He uses the resurrection stone not to just bring the people he loves back from the dead, but to bring them back from the dead so that he can hear from them the encouragement that he needs to be able to follow through with it. And so he uses the Deathly Hallows not to escape death, but to embrace death and to kill death with death. And that is the true power to defeat death, is to use the Deathly Hallows to die the right way at the right time. And Harry's self-awareness of this and his embrace of the prophecy, like I think of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, having this very similar moment to Harry. Like, oh man, the prophecies say I got to do this. God's telling me I got to do this. I'm praying to God to if there is a way, spare this cup from me, Father. But nevertheless, not my will, but your will, right? Mm-hmm. And that being like this climactic victory in human history. And that, you know, I think the person who gives that moment the greatest refreshment and life in narrative is J.K. Rowling in the Harry Potter
story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, one of the most powerful scenes is when Harry has a snitch in his hands and he's, I'm ready to die.
Yeah. Like,
as I've made this, because at the end of the day, you know, Snape says, are you like a pig to the slaughter? Dumbledore doesn't answer that. I mean, he probably could have an answer, but he addresses something totally different, which is important to Snape's character, but it's never answered. But Dumbledore doesn't sacrifice Harry. He gives Harry what he needs in order to understand the choice that needs to be made. And then yeah. Harry makes the choice.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
Harry says, I'm ready to die. And he goes and he actually does it.
Dumbledore was leaving the breadcrumbs to enable Harry to reach that moral victory at that moment.
Dumbledore knew it was necessary, but doesn't force Harry to do it. He just leads Harry towards that choice, and then Harry makes the choice. And Harry does what he needs to make the choice.
The profundity of that is just amazing. And to have a story that climaxes that way is just so great. And I have to say, Narnia just can't shake a candle at that moment as it's delivered in the Harry Potter story.
Yeah, you know, and I read Narnia as a kid, loved it. Read Harry Potter, loved it. And it made me go and revisit Narnia because it had been a while. And I read the Narnia books. And I enjoyed them, but not even close to the same way.
And the thing that the Narnia books and C.S. Lewis in general, he's just terrible at character development. And J.K. Rowling is one of the best character developers of all time.
Oh yeah.
And I think that C.S. Lewis often uses his characters as sort of idea sock puppets. I have that criticism of the Space Trilogy. The Space Trilogy has its awesome moments, but too often the characters seem like idea sock puppets, kind of like Ayn Rand characters, where I'm just setting up this character so I get to speak my ideas through them, or you know, metaphysical tools or something like that. But I think J.K. Rowling is right that in order for them to be able to speak the ideas or embody the ideas, they really have to have the compellingness of a real character.
Yeah. I mean, I think of Sirius. It makes me think of Sirius Black. So he's presented differently in the book than in the movie, mainly because he's not as present in the movie. So, I mean, he seems almost wise in the movie. Where in the book, he never gives up on being an immature little prick. Like, he still hates Snape. And to a certain degree, you wonder if the reason that he hates Snape is because Snape is everything he could have been. Like, he's in Slytherin, like, it's like every other part of his family. He's brilliant. Yeah. And so he just can't stand him. And that Snape, through Snape's work, kind of Harry, James and Lily, his best friend, was offered the best protection there was. But through Sirius's work, his best friend was killed. It's like, you protected my best friend better than I could. You protected my godson all these years better than I could. And so he still has all this resentment towards Snape. And it's like, that's so realistic. Like, Sirius is one of the good guys, but he's still deep down a little jerk. And it's like, we see that a lot of time.
And like, he dislikes his parents. What's that? Perhaps Sirius's weakness is that he dislikes his parents. And that he can't quite learn to love his family. Yeah, his family was a little bad, but he can't return there's a certain ingredient of family love missing reciprocally in Sirius.
Yeah, and we see that with, like, you know, there's all the tribalism that's going on. You know, hey, I'm a conservative, I'm whatever, blah, blah, blah. There are people on my team or on my side, in my tribe, whatever, that are pretty messed up. Like, that I don't agree with every ideological aspect, or maybe we do agree, but they're just jerks. But that exists everywhere. That doesn't necessarily mean they're wrong about the side that they're fighting on. It doesn't mean that they're kind of jerks. And it's similar. It's like those flaws exist everywhere. Again, as a Calvinist, everybody's totally depraved. Everybody has that corruption inside of them. And that is displayed and throughout the books, especially in every character. Like Hermione in the movies is almost flawless. But in the books, she makes mistakes, like significant ones.
She makes it, yeah. And her mistake is rule followiness, mm-hmm. right? That's one of her weaknesses is that she has to overcome is she loves following the rules. Yeah. And that it takes Harry and Ron to kind of help her, get around that particular weakness. Her book smartishness is helpful, but her people-pleasy rule-followiness is her weakness.
And it's
because what happens when the go ahead.
And the Half-Blood Prince, where Harry is like, Draco's a Death Eater. He's been co-opted. He's trying to kill Dumbledore, and she's like, "No, Harry, you're wrong. You just hate him," and blah 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 blah. And in a certain degree, like Remus Lupin is kind of like the older version of the Hermione character because he's saying the same thing. No, you're just letting your resentment cloud your thoughts. And at the end of the day, they were wrong. And wrong in big ways. Like if they had jumped on Harry's side earlier, they might have been able to prevent that. But they didn't, you know. And so they're all deeply flawed. And that's kind of the beauty of it, is that there is no perfect character in this story.
But don't you think that Dumbledore was also trying to hope that that he was letting that happen? He knew Dumbledore knew full well.
Yeah.
The whole but time, they didn't, and so it's almost perhaps better in a way that they weren't able to stop Malfoy because it was part of Dumbledore's plan was to both allow Malfoy to get to that point, but at the end, he's also trying to give Malfoy redemption chance, and I think the kindness that Dumbledore shows Malfoy does help turn Malfoy and does help destroy Voldemort. And that it was also needed in some sense for Snape to secure the final trust of Voldemort in order to be able to betray him at the crucial moment.
And that's kind of what I'm getting at, is that not only is everybody flawed, but their flaws contribute to the story in important ways.
There's a lot of
There's
a lot of what you meant for evil God means for good in Harry Potter. In a lot of creative and very brilliant ways. And almost every character gets sewn into that in some way or another.
Yeah, and in a variety of levels, too. Like different levels of analysis. You go deeper and deeper, and it's like, one of the things that just occurred to me is, you know, there's a big different fan theory of whether Harry actually died. And whether he went into limbo and came back. So based on kind of what you were saying a little earlier about the Elder Wand and whatnot, it just occurs to me, I don't think Harry did die. Because the Elder Wand was loyal to Harry and therefore wouldn't have killed him. But what the Elder Wand did was, because it wasn't loyal to Voldemort, it killed the piece of Voldemort inside of Harry. So it's like, that's an interesting... Because it's like, well, how did he come back? Like, what is it that brought him back? Was it just the law of love? Maybe. And I, when you examine so many of these different facets, they do kind of work. Like, I've watched a plot hole videos in Harry Potter. And there are very few, I can't think of one right now that was pointed out that I didn't explain.
Did I lose you?
What's that? No. I was just I haven't been able to find a plot hole in a Harry Potter that somebody's come up with that I haven't been able to find an explanation for.
Yeah. And they even have time travel a little bit, which is like the mother of all plot hole introducers, right? Although they only deal with that in book three. And I think it's perhaps wise. Perhaps you can think of, well, what if we had time turners this whole time? Or something like that.
Yeah.
But the thing is like, you actually have to get to the place where Harry's willing to die to defeat Voldemort. And like, how in the world are you expecting time turners to be able to fix this? and there's sort of what's that apocryphal book afterwards, the one that was a play,
The Cursed Child.
Yeah, The Cursed Child. We don't need to spend too much time talking about
that. That's why that doesn't work.
Yeah.
Because you know, there's two approaches to time travel in fiction. There's the closed loop, which is what Prisoner of Azkaban was. It's that whatever you experienced happened already because of the time travel. You're not going to change anything because, like, everything that happened before Hermione went back in time still happened after she went back in time. It was just that her going back in time is what caused it initially. So that's the closed loop version of time travel. Then there's Back to the Future open, where you're going to create alternate timelines and yada, 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 yada. And so Rowling had the closed loop version, and but then The Cursed Child has more of the open. You can go back and actually change things. And it's like, no, that's stupid. That doesn't work. Yeah. And to a certain degree, it can't be canon because of that.
Yeah. What do you think about Ron and Hermione ending up together? If I were to criticize something, I still think that probably at the end of the day, Hermione and Harry should have gotten together. And I also find Ginny to strangely be perhaps the most vacuous character in Harry Potter.
So after watching the movies, I agreed with that. After reading the books, and especially reading the book several times, I don't. For a few reasons. And that I think go along with reality pretty significantly. One is that it's hard to cross the city bound. If you've ever had, like, I remember grew up with a very tight-knit group that felt more like family. I could never imagine myself having dated any girls that grew up in a church. We weren't blood relatives, but we felt such a family. I couldn't overcome that in my mind. I think that's what Hermione came up as a sister to Harry, and I don't think he could ever in his mind cross that. Secondly, is part of the thing that connects Ginny and Harry. Well, there's two aspects. One is that Voldemort actually possessed Ginny in book two. And so there's a way that she can relate to Harry that Hermione can't understand. There's a way that she understands Harry and that Harry understands her that you're not going to find in anybody else. The second thing is that Harry saves her life in kind of a very intimate way. It's just the two of them left over and the Chamber of Secrets. And that, again, leaves something both in her mind and in Harry's mind that you just don't get rid of. And then add to that the idea that Harry ends up being a high status guy and she becomes very highly desirable female in a way that Hermione never was. And so that kind of, they fit in that level of reality as well. And so I think there's a way that the relationship was portrayed in the movies that after watching the movies several times, Ginny and Harry still make more sense to me. But not on the first or second view.
And part of it might have been that Ginny's actress wasn't perhaps the most compelling.
Yeah, she wasn't given a lot either. She was more compelling when she was younger. It was harder when she was older. Because they just didn't give her a lot of time for the character to breathe. But there's like certain jokes that she makes in the books that it's like, okay, that kind of fits with Harry a little bit more. And you see the more the parallels between Lily and James and Harry and Ginny. Yeah. And that's the other aspect is Ginny looks a lot more like Harry's mom. And you end up doing that a little bit. It's a little bit creepy.
And Harry always kind of wanted to join the Weasley family. And so he marries into it. Yeah.
I could see that Harry and Hermione, but when you get deeper, I think it's better for Harry and Ginny and then Ron and Hermione.
The romance that I actually think might have even been better that was left on the table would be Malfoy and Hermione. I think that there is something strangely compelling about that idea, and that could have been perhaps even more a prominent part of Malfoy's redemption arc, is to overcome his blood prejudice by marrying a muggle-born. And and that their like antagonism, you know, turning into a romance and like perhaps some team up moment at some point in time, like a Malfoy Hermione team up. This is a pretty cool idea.
I think it's a cool idea, but I don't think it's realistic. In the terms of the narrative, mainly because of the what saves Draco, and to a certain degree, it's arguable whether or not he was actually saved, or whether or not he actually became good, so much as the opportunity of redemption was saved for him. He didn't go down the bad path. But the big reason is because of the familial love, because of mom and dad. And so for him to completely go against mom and dad in that way, I don't think that character would. Because to a certain degree, that is what saved him to a certain degree.
Because at the end of the day, even in his weird family, his parents still loved him. And he actually kind of had, in some sense, one of the healthiest families.
His parents loved him and loved his parents.
Yeah, and his parents loved each other.
And so it's really weird that way, but I think it's true. And there was something else you made me think about that I found. Oh, now something I was just reminded about is Petunia and the uncle, Vernon.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of fan theories talking about a lot of aspects of that family, why they're so messed up. Because they're a decent muggle parallel to the Malfoys. Very prejudiced against magic, loves their single son.
Other.
But one thing that doesn't really get talked about is where were Lily's parents? Like, where were Lily's parents? What about James' parents? I mean, Rowling talked about them dying of different things, like James' parents died of dragon pox or something like that. But the idea of the possibility of Lily's parents, the possibility of them having been killed during the previous war, as you know, they're trying to hunt down James and Lily, but they're hidden with the Fidelius charm while they find their parents. And this might be actually the motivation for Hermione obliviating her parents so they don't remember her, so Deathies wouldn't go after them to find her. But then if that's the case, if somehow it makes sense, because the big question everybody asks is, why wouldn't they be happy to send Harry away to Hogwarts? If they hate him, they don't want him in their house, they're constantly complaining about him, and yet they are trying to keep him away from Hogwarts in the beginning. Why would they do that? It makes sense if it took everything outside of her family that was important to her. Sure, she resented her sister, but now her sister's dead. And you know what? Her parents are gone too. And she's gotten everything that Hogwarts represents has brought negativity to me and my family. And so even though I don't like you and you represent something awful for me, I don't want you to bring more of that into my life, so to speak. And it just shows the power that had, like the power of not coming to terms with history and the resentment and so on and so forth. It's just in ways that we don't even understand.
And that just conflicted and confused motivations, right?
Yeah. And this is displayed in like a deleted scene in the movies. They have a scene where she's standing in her living room and she tells Harry, you know, you didn't just lose a mother that night, but I lost a sister. Like, it's like, yeah, I resented her, but she was my sister. Somewhere deep down, there was love there. And I'm sitting in this empty living room where I raised my son and we had this whole life. And it's like, everything was taken from me. My household now, my sister, potentially even my parents. It's just like, it starts to make you understand why she treated Harry like shit the whole time.
That is an interesting thing. I also, let's see here. I feel like Ron is not like the most interesting character. I don't know. I mean, he plays a lot of important roles and stuff like that, but it's a lot of seemingly being in the right place at the right time, as he sometimes complains. What do you think of Ron's character?
I think there's a different Ron in the movie than in the book. But I do appreciate both of them. I mean, so in the movie, you get a bit more glimpse of him, like, during the chess match. He's like, I'll sacrifice. No, Harry, you have to do this.
Because, Yeah.
And what Dumbledore is trying to say is that you need your friends as the motivation. Ron and Hermione, as much as Harry falls for Ginny, Ron and Hermione become like his family. And they're his impetus towards everything. When Voldemort possesses Harry in the movie, it's when Ron and Hermione come in and he thinks of all the times, all the things that they've been through together. And that's when he says, I feel sorry for you because you don't know what it's like to have these guys. Yeah, and that's seen more in the books, for sure. But it's also demonstrated in the movies a bit. Is that Ron is this guy that is always by Harry's side. Even when he resents Harry in book four, he finds out about the dragons, he still tries to find a way to communicate that to Harry.
Yeah. So to get a little meta in a certain way, one thing I wonder about is, so what is the effect of Christian art on culture? Because I think you and I both agree that Harry Potter is strikingly Christian, sometimes almost surprisingly so, given Rowling's sort of later woke-ish, but not quite woke enough political views. And part of me wonders how much she transformed in her political views after she had finished Harry Potter, and if she wrote them at the right time, whereas woke J.K. Rowling might not have been able to write Harry Potter. And so there might have been sort of a progression in her own mind there. But it's not like, because a weird thing was that, you know, the Christian right, especially in America, did not like Harry Potter. And so they were sort of embraced by the weird kids. And a lot of LGBTQ kids found various allegories in the story for them, even though there was, despite retconning Dumbledore's own homosexuality, which plays zero role in the actual books, there was no real gayness in the book. It was sort of embraced by the left wing of our culture and sort of the outcasts and the fringe, that in sort of a left wing coded way, but it doesn't seem to have had too big of an obvious Christian effect on them, or maybe I'm wrong about that. I don't know. What do you think about the question of, if these books are so Christian, what sort of Christian effect did they have on the people who read them?
So I think, for the Christian people that read them, I think it's had a significant impact. I mean, us having this conversation is kind of evidence of that. But as I talk to more and more Christians that have read them, it's had similar impact on them as it has had on myself. I think the biggest aspect is that you had the political right wing prevented a lot of people from reading or reading the books, really. You can get some of the same elements from the movie, but I don't know that it goes as deep. But I think the political situation did was kept this piece of art away from a large portion of the Christian audience. But I think, so I regularly have conversations with even Christians that are fairly left wing, and we can get into Harry Potter discussions and have really great deep discussions. And to a certain degree, it's almost a tool that allows me to challenge some of their current ideologies. Yeah.
There's some red pills.
Yeah.
There's some red pills in there.
Yeah, and there is a lot. And you know, somebody put a meme up. I think I mentioned this at our meetup group, that one of the issues for this generation is they all grew up reading Harry Potter and imagining themselves as Harry, Ron, and Hermione, and grew up to become Rita Spears or Umbridges, and they don't know how to cope because they don't want to see themselves as the villains, similar to those characters in the book. They don't want to see themselves as the villains. I see that there is a lot of that is people that grew up reading that and thinking, there's no way I could ever become these evil characters. And it's just like, not many of you did. But in the terms of, like, you talked about the idea of Christian art and the effect. Well, there's a few aspects of Christianity. There's where we came from, where we're going, where we are, and then how are we moved from those three different territories, the movement there. And I think, like, that this book does that well. I mean, it doesn't really address where we came from. It does address some of where these, not necessarily where we came from in terms of creation, but where our identities have come from. The love of our parents, the generations before, that all has a bit, plays into it a bit. Where we're going in terms of to death and potentially into eternity afterwards. And then how do we get there and how ought we to get there? And that's through, there is a pattern to live out, to get there well, and that is the Christ story. And I think Christian art composed well and received well helps, is like a map telling us how to get from where we are to where we're going in the best way.
Yeah. I think a weird thing that has happened due to the alleged canceling of J.K. Rowling is that the political coding of Harry Potter is now up for grabs. It's not like the right wing has embraced it, but the left wing, the hyper left wing, is trying to, you know, discredit J.K. Rowling, and eventually they're trying to separate her from her books for now. But eventually they'll come after the books, especially once they start to notice some of the red pills in the books. But then I think that leaves it open for a right-wing embrace of Harry Potter that probably should have happened all along, but was strangely prevented due to circumstance of happening. And that it's like, okay, I think Richard Rowling said this one time. I wish he could have been here. Maybe next conversation. But he said something like, okay, so the left wing wants NASCAR and Bud Light, and they're willing to leave us Harry Potter in exchange. That seems like a deal I'll take.
Yeah.
and I think that this, I think that because these books will age really well. And I think one thing that was helpful about them is they were written before the age of smartphones and social media. So, but just before. And so they're kind of untouched by technology in a way that's sort of strange, that will make them feel kind of timeless and nostalgic for a time before smartphones ruling schools. And that I think generations of people will come to this. And I think that I do think that for Christian art to have its full effect, people, whether they're Christians or not, do need to have their brain clicked on in such a way as to realize the Christianness of the art. Christian art that people don't necessarily recognize as Christian, because I think huge amounts of people do not think of Harry Potter as Christian. If anything, they still remember from their childhood when the Christian right didn't like it. Yep. And that I think there, but it has left a switch primed in them that can be flicked on. It's like, so you really admire Harry. What do you admire about Harry? Okay. Who embodies that even more and better? What does that mean for you? And I still think that, kind of like I said earlier, there is something strangely magical about theology at its deepest level. Because like I said, in what other logic does it make sense that Jesus dying for our sins saves us through the washing of his blood, right? Like, this is an extremely weird form of thinking and talking. But that Harry Potter opens up a weird pathway for a modern mind because it does this enchantment thing, right? And we probably didn't talk about this enough, this like pathway into the magical world through Diagon Alley, where we're allowed to re-enchant our brains for a second, and for a while, it feels like, oh, haha, it's just fun. It's just entertainment. It's just fantasy, you know, whatever. It's just harmless. Don't think too much about it. But it's like, what exactly is your brain doing there when you're letting that re-enchantment back in the door? And why does that feel so compelling? And what exactly is missing in our lives now that doesn't have that? And what does that say about our brains that we just find that so enrapturing?
Yeah, and I think the idea of like juxtaposing the magical, the enchantment, the mystical with the logical, there is a dance to be done there. And sometimes we err on the side of the magical and we act stupidly. And sometimes we err on the side of logic and we lose our enchantment. I mean, one of the things that I feel like the Christian world really struggles with is the idea that Christian art doesn't necessarily need to be made by Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes mm-hmm. Some of the best Christian art isn't made by Christians. Like, I mean, I think of The Matrix. The Matrix is, in my opinion, very Christian art. I don't think you would talk
about a little Gnostic-ish.
Well, I mean,
a little bit of Gnosticism. Yes.
A little bit, but it's one of those. So if you look at the trilogy of The Matrix, and this might be a bit too much of a challenge, but a tangent, but I'll try to make it brief, is you have the first movie, which is kind of like the Christ story. He gives his life, is resurrected, and comes to save the world through his death.
Yeah.
Death and resurrection. He becomes the one. Maybe it's Unitarian in that way. he becomes the one. But then you have the movie 2, where it introduces all these other different philosophies, all these different forms and yada, yada, yada. But then you get to the third movie, and at the end of the third movie, he has to die to save the world. And it's like, yes, we have the Christian story. And then we flirted with all these other ideas through enlightenment, through different religions. But it all has to come back to the Christ story of the chosen one laying down his life to save the world. Mm-hmm. And that is the Christian story. Everybody can try the rest. And there's some merit maybe to the ideas, or there's some ways, that kind of makes sense here. But at the end of the day, none of them can compete with it. At the end of the day, at the top of the hierarchy is the Christ story.
Right. And an interesting thing that The Matrix and Harry Potter share in common is that they're very self-aware within the stories of having a Messiah figure. Like, they just straight up say it. There's the one who's been prophesied. Right. Are you the one? Are you? And in Harry Potter, are you the chosen one? And it's like, okay, when John the Baptist sends his delegates, Jesus, are you the one that we are waiting for, or should we wait for another? Right. It's like, yeah, this self-awareness of a Messiah figure in the story should be a clue as to what world we're living in here.
I agree with that. And the fact that it doesn't necessitate somebody trying to write Christian ideology into it for Christian, there was a lot of argument in the Catholic Church decades ago. There probably still is argument about it, about Paul McCartney's song "Let It Be," speaking words of wisdom. Mother Mary comes to me, let it be. Paul McCartney denies that he's talking about the Virgin Mary at all. He says, "No, that's just what they used to call my mom," and so I wrote the song about my mom. And it's like, that song is so stinking Catholic, and what it's and the message, that I don't even know that Paul McCartney understands what he was writing when he wrote it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing. You don't have to necessarily intend for it to be. And I think this is where a lot of the Christian media really screws up, is they're trying to write this ideology into their movies, and they're trying to be so careful to get the ideology right that it ends up sucking. It's like, where if they were just really trying to write the truest story they could possibly write, it's going to end up being Christian.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And it does take someone who's only sort of marginally connected maybe to Christianity to be able to pull that off sometimes. Tolkien, he's an exception. Tolkien is uniquely talented in these sorts of things. But like I said, C.S. Lewis, Narnia, sometimes it's a little bit too on the nose, a little, and not enough character and those sorts of things. I don't think that's one reason why I don't think Narnia is quite as good. It's a little bit too self-aware of its Christianness sometimes. I don't know.
I also wonder if it was partially because of a different era. Mm-hmm. So that was written before televisions, where people could see movies and see everything work out. Your imagination when reading a book was a lot more active.
Yeah.
Whereas with Rowling, and she's writing books in an era of motion pictures, movies, television, internet was coming about, and she had to be a lot more detailed. She had to unpack these things a lot, and our minds just work differently and process information differently. So, I mean, because people still read Narnia to this day. I mean, it's what, almost, how many years? 60, 70 years later? And people are still reading them and still appreciating them, even with it, not to the same degree. Right now, we're about, 20, 30 years after when did the first book come out? 97?
Sounds about right.
So what, 27 years later, people are still loving it. And I imagine that it will continue. But I would also imagine in about 50 years or so, there's going to have to be a new story that comes about that redoes this in a compelling way.
The first book came out June 1997. Yep, you're right. And so to get a little bit meta again, I feel like, yeah, we can use Christianity to help us understand Harry Potter, but there are times where I feel like Harry Potter should be used to help us understand Christianity because it can do such a good job of re-enlightening our imagination to get us to see the Christian story with fresh eyes again. That's really perhaps the best achievement that Christian art can hope for, is to reawaken us through artistic means to the truth of Christianity that's been there the whole time, that might have been hard for us to see or appreciate or feel the depths of. And I think that what Harry Potter does the best for me when I think about this question is it helps me think about what would it take to make a perfect Messiah? Like, what that Jesus doesn't just defeat Satan head on in some sort of I'm stronger than you, I win because, you know, I'm God or whatever. Right. And I'll try not to be too Unitarian in what I'm about to say. I think a Trinitarian could mostly agree with what I'm going to say, but I can't help myself sometimes. But thinking about, like, you know, like in the book of Revelation, there's the scroll that God on the throne is holding. And the John is crying and the angels are crying because there's no one worthy to open the scroll. And who is worthy to open the scroll? No one on heaven or earth or under the earth was found to be worthy to open the scroll. Like, what does it take to have someone be worthy to open the scroll? What does it really take to defeat evil? What, it, just like how we were talking about earlier, how the more powerful the magic trick, the more difficult the ingredients or the skills required to achieve the magic trick in Harry Potter. Well, defeating death and evil and Satan for all time, well, that's going to require a heck of a spell to pull that off. And what it is Jesus's life lived perfectly, but it's not just, he can't just be an innocent baby either. It can't be that Jesus is born and he's this perfectly sinless, innocent, you know, baby, and we'll just throw him up on a cross and that will do the trick, right? Jesus has to go through the maturation process. He has to defeat every sin. He has to be tempted in every way that we are, yet without sin. He has to say no to every form of temptation, including being offered by Satan all of the power to rule the world without having to go through crucifixion. And to be able to say no to that, and instead of using the power for himself, who, though he was in the form of God existing, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but empties himself, he has to go down and refuse to use power selfishly, and to use power instead to sacrifice himself. And because of that, he gets given all power and glory and honor and wisdom and might and, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Worthy is the Lamb, right? Because he was slain. And that, I think, can help us read Revelation or Philippians 2 or all these other passages. And thinking about Harry Potter, because Harry Potter helps, you know, connect with us better because it seems fresher and more relatable, we can then take some of those insights and see the Jesus story with even more power and magnificence than we had before. And I think that's really the ultimate gift of Harry Potter.
Yeah, I agree. And it's why I use Harry Potter illustrations more than any other thing and when I preach, because there's so much richness there. And, you know, when I preach, I have a variety of ages, and it really does connect with young people. I'm actually working on an idea. I haven't put a lot of effort into it yet beyond conceptualization. Developing catechism in my church plant, utilizing Harry Potter, like connecting principles that are demonstrated in Harry Potter narrative to Heidelberg Catechism, and using that as a pathway in for young people to help them look at the Christian story as not just this religion of my fathers, but this is something you can live out right now at your age.
Yeah. All right. Any last closing thoughts before we wrap this up?
Not that I can think of right now.
All right. Kale, Richard, we welcome you into the next one. And while we covered a lot of ground, there's still a lot left untapped. And so I like connecting Harry Potter to the medieval world. Because, like, when is Harry Potter set? Okay, in some sense, it's set in 1997. In some sense, it's basically set in medieval Europe. Right? And so I feel like Richard can do a good job of illuminating those sorts of things. So,
and even just going into Harry Potter, what are they going to do with it now? Because they've tried the different attempts at bringing more ideas. Like, the Fantastic Beasts has really tried to focus on the gayness of Dumbledore. And that didn't work.
Yeah. What's the cultural impact of that prequel trilogy? Blah. aren't they getting ready to make a new, not a movie, but a TV series?
A TV series. And it's supposed to stay faithful to the books because Rowling is involved. But we'll see how far she might
meddle with her own story. Yeah.
Yeah.
That'll be curious. Because I do think that they can get a little deeper than in a TV series than they are able to get in the show or in the movies. Because they could basically have it be the same length as an audiobook, essentially.
Yeah, I would love that. But they have the potential for good and they have the potential for evil.
We'll see. My faith in Hollywood to do things correctly nowadays is virtually none. But if there was one person that I still might trust, it might be J.K. Rowling to make sure that she has the authority to have it happen the right way and to not just retcon gayness into a story for no reason other than political point scoring, which is ironically what Christian art does when it fails, is just try and score cheap points like that. And now, for whatever reason, it's the woke who do that, and they make basically, the reason why woke movies suck is the same reason why a lot of Christian movies suck, is because it's just too on the nose, too obvious, and not artistic and faithful to the story.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's trying to be shallowly true and not deeply true.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. All right. But Harry Potter was deeply true, and I can't think of a better way to end than that. All right. We'll probably talk again, Moises. Thanks for your time.
Sounds good.